Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson-Owens.
And it's the 10th of December. What important event involving the United Nations occurred on the 10th of December, 1948, Paul?
Its inception, maybe?
Human Rights Day.
Yes, is,
Universal Declaration of Human Rights is correct.
Yeah, I understand John Bolton's having a little tiff on the floor about that. I thought I had a quote of him.
It's quite remarkable, you know, that it passed absolutely without, I mean, it's unremarked. I mean, it's not remarkable in the sense that the U.S. is obviously doing all it can to make sure that Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not known. But, I mean, still, that the day should be the anniversary and that it should not be mentioned is, you know, too bad at least. Huh?
These people are generally pretty good on rhetoric, though. I don't think Condi has really covered herself with appellation.
What an understatement.
Yeah.
I mean, lying, you know, the 17th century definition of an ambassador is someone who lies abroad for the good of their country. Mm. You know, well, I mean, Condi certainly has fulfilled that. What an amazing opera. And the Europeans have bought it.
That's what's not true is that that's what you hear here. People that report back say the diplomats, well, diplomats are known to be diplomatic as well as, you know, they're telling lies too. But their Spiegel has a headline. Does anybody believe Condoleezza Rice?
Well, the reason that Der Spiegel has that headline is the first person who believed Condoleezza Rice was the new Chancellor of Germany, and German diplomats and British ones are top of the list. This is not good.
Well, but they couldn't even choreograph that correctly, where they said she admitted a mistake on this Masri case. You know, Masri means Egypt in the Egyptian language. So, I mean, it's like having Mr. Smith.
The Egyptian,
And they didn't double check to see if Mr. Smith was indeed anything like the Mr. Smith they were looking for. So, you know.
More lies, yes. But, I mean, it's Condi's lying. And then she's followed around by by this little guy who says, well, of course, we're not bound by the Geneva Conventions because these people are not traditional soldiers, right. These people being the people that the U.S. has thrown into their gulag. So we're told in this country that we're in a war without end, a war against terrorism, the most extreme form, et cetera, et cetera. It's a war. Of course it's a war, and this is our commander-in-chief commanding the war, but these are not prisoners of war, and therefore the laws concerning prisoners of war do not apply to them. And this guy on the NSA staff is following Condi around, saying all this stuff, and making clear that when she says, when she sets down these lies about torture, it's all surrounded by a bodyguard of other lies concerning the U.S. obligation under the Geneva Conventions, etc. It's shocking.
I don't know if he's the same guy that suggests that, well, waterboarding is not
Not
torture.
That's right.
Whether he himself or maybe Dick Cheney would experience it, would find it to be torturous.
Yeah,
of course,
I think
Dick Cheney's, his circuits might
let's waterboard Cheney. That would be worthwhile.
It's not torture.
Uh-huh. Sure not.
It might kill you if you have a bad heart, I suppose.
We could finally answer the plane questions. You know, who did reveal?
Interrogation methods. Her artfully crafted. You know, it is not our policy.
Yes.
She didn't say it was against the law.
Oh, she also said it's not our policy, and we haven't done it.
Mm.
That's the amazing thing. We haven't sent people abroad to be tortured.
Right.
I mean, the bold-faced lies. She's as bad a liar as her predecessor. I mean, Colin Powell at the United Nations sets down a whole series of lies that gets us into the war, his successor follows it around and offers lies about how we're conducting the war. It's incredible.
Ken Silverstein, a former colleague of Alexander Coburn, maybe they're still colleagues, I guess, but he's kept his job at the LA Times. There have been mass firing.
Hard to do.
Apparently he's still a staff reporter, and he has a story out that's cited by most of the Common Dreams, et cetera, about a case about Majid Mahmoud Abu Ahmad, a detainee at Pentagon, who the lawyer for this guy actually got to see the actual Pentagon document. He wasn't able to reproduce it in his filing in favor of the guy, but this is sort of the smoking gun that says, well, we want to render this guy where he can go beyond waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
Torture has worked for this administration, though. It's now even the regular media is saying something we've said a while back, which was, they got this information about the supposed Al-Qaeda connection from a guy that the Egyptians beat it out of.
Exactly.
So torture was very useful for this administration.
Indeed.
They got exactly the story. In fact, I wonder whether Cheney did any of it when he was visiting the CIA. Maybe he was waterboarding some people to get them to say exactly what he wanted to say in the lead-up to the war.
Yeah, I doubt that he would put the strain on his heart, assuming he has one. But the story and on the front page of the New York Times that the connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda were made up by a guy under torture in Egypt, and that this is the sort of thing that the administration was relying on when they knew perfectly well, that this is how the information was obtained. Now, I mean, there's an important point here, I think, in general on the administration's position, Paul. The administration, if pressed on the obvious flaws in the argument for this war, immediately sings bad intelligence and blames it on the CIA and George Tenet and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, they were lying because they knew what they were saying wasn't true, and here's a perfect example.
Let's see. Dana Priest had the article about the German citizen of Arab descent, of Lebanese descent, who was hijacked in Macedonia. That's Masri. No,
this is Al-Masri. Right, yeah.
Somebody called him Lebanese, but I guess he, of course, might have been a Lebanese living abroad.
Well, like a number of these people, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
but Masri actually does, as I say, mean Egypt. Mm-hmm. Egypt. So
this is
it's a very common last name.
The Americans are sometimes surprised how cosmopolitan the Arab world is. That is, in the sense that people do move around from place to place, and that the average Arab has probably moved more than the average American from the place of his birth.
Right. Well, that's one of their grievances, is that they don't have governments that are doing anything except servicing the foreign corporations
right.
and Comprador regime classically and not doing the development, so they have to go work in Saudi Arabia. And
exactly.
I'll repeat what I mentioned, I think it was just last week, that these people that we call Saudi that were on the planes in 911 were actually Egyptian guest worker progeny, and they were not...
progeny, but they, most of them were born in Saudi Arabia.
Right, but they were the...
Exactly, part of this.
Sons of people that came from Egypt to work in Saudi Arabia. So
the Arab diaspora, perhaps.
Yeah. Turmoil, if you will.
The Al-Masri, I gather, is suing the CIA, and I believe George Tenet personally, but he is not allowed into the United States to press his suit in the courts. So
I've heard the argument made that the same inept identification of him, his name came up on the watch list, so they did, which is why they nabbed him in the first place. But it's
well,
it staggers the mind that they wouldn't have known who the guy really was, since there was so much publicity about him. But you know, that's possible.
Ted Kennedy's name keeps coming up on the watch list, apparently. He gets finds it's difficult. I mean, you know, given the fact that Ted Kennedy is approaching critical mass himself, it's why it's pretty clear that who he is.
Is he one of the six senators, three Democrats, and three Republicans that are going to stand against the Patriot Act?
I think he's been mentioned at that, and Feingold and Durbin are two of the other Democrats. This is interesting. I called Durbin's office yesterday to say that, you know, I hope that he would carry out his promise to filibuster the Patriot Act. This so-called compromise on the Patriot Act is terrible. It's a bad piece of, I mean, it's a bad piece of work that simply continues the worst features of the Patriot Act. And so there is talk, as you say, of a filibuster. It would be very interesting to see if our senators do it. I also called our junior senator's office and urged him to take a role in the filibuster. I'd be willing to take money. I'd be willing to bet money that he doesn't if there
well,
is
maybe
a filibuster.
Somebody will take
but
a
we'll
bet.
See.
But
we'll
if
see.
There's a lot of response, I suggest people email or call.
Yes, exactly.
Call them both and say, please,
please
do
this.
Not fall for this. What is it? What is the full name of it again? Patriot Act? What does the acronym stand for?
Oh, who knows? And
it has no relation to what it actually does, so I guess it's not important particularly.
But this is the so-called conference report announced with great fanfare the other day that the White House had reached a compromise on the Patriot Act. Well, the compromise is the conference report and with slight language changes, and the compromise is only the willingness of the Republican senators to push this forward as they had pushed and a good number of Democrats as well. This crosses party lines, to push this forward as they'd push the Patriot forward originally.
One of the things it does, I haven't examined it terribly closely, but it extends the sunset.
Yep.
Pushes the sunset into the future.
Makes the sun
years.
Stop, right?
Yeah.
Like Joshua.
You can believe that.
in any case, it certainly is very worthwhile to call our senators and say, put a stop to this if you possibly can.
Someone at Slate, and I wasn't able to get to this article, maybe it was getting in high demand on the web this morning when I was trying to look for it. Grade school children invite Marines to reunion. This was translated back from the Baghdad Post. This is the result of the Pentagon paying for good stories. Includes quotes from kids saying, God bless America, support George Bush, hey GI, give me candy. So this is the kind of thing. And I speculated that I had no particular evidence that these good news stories that were planted by the Pentagon then are repercussed back into our media. If they didn't directly in a cited form, they certainly were pointed to as evidence to believe that things were, the media just reports the bad news.
We get these plaintive cries from the far right saying, why don't you promote, the media report the good news about it?
Sinclair Broadcasting was Fox. Actually, Fox was doing launching a whole campaign about that, and it was right at the time when the Abu Ghraib photos were coming out, so they were their campaign was a little undercut by that. I think that might actually predate them, these stories being bought, but I don't know the story of that. Some ex-admiral has been appointed to investigate what's been going on with these purchases of good news stories.
And in the meantime...
I'm sure that'll go real well.
And in the meantime, the administration has managed to try up in court the other pictures from Abu Ghraib that the ACLU has been trying to pry loose, pictures that Rumsfeld, for example, has said are really quite horrible, and they've managed to keep the lid on that with no problem at all. And has been pointed out, I mean, the people, the objects of their concern are, of course, the American public. It's the American public that the administration is trying to keep in the dark about what the torture policy really was, because, of course, the torture policy is perfectly well known by the people who were its objects in Iraq. So, nevertheless, the courts and the government have managed to make it clear that you are not to see these pictures.
Oh, but these are clearly exceptional aberrations, as Condi encouraged us to
bad
believe.
Apples.
And they don't use that expression anymore, but they still make the same.
But the lying goes
same
on.
Argument.
I mean, Rice in Europe is lying about the Italians are talking about how they were lied to about the CIA's operations there. Poland has obviously lied at American direction on not having a CIA prison in Poland. They do. It's everyone admits they do now. And the Poles said, well, you know.
Well, they flew him out in time for Condi to be able to say we have no prisoners
exactly.
here. Right.
Exactly.
But she didn't use the past tense.
But they have a new and they have a new apparently a new military base, a new American prison on an American military base in Romania.
Yeah.
So the lies just keep rolling
well,
on.
It's actually a base that was already being used, but they've actually just gone from de facto use of it to a actually treated use of it. So
yeah,
again, they had to spirit the detainees out so it could be signed and saying, well, we don't have anybody here.
Right.
So where they went to was probably, you know, Morocco, Egypt, I suppose.
But so foreign policy lies, congressional lies about the Patriot Act, for example. I like the compromise on the torture amendment that the administration is pressing forward, too. You know, compromise it right out of existence. It's, you know, treat it the way they've treated, the Senate has treated habeas corpus recently, mm-hmm. Where our junior senator, by the way, did vote on the wrong side of that. And
egad.
Yeah, that's not good.
Well, maybe he expects the Constitution to rule it, or the courts to rule it unconstitutional, since a writ of habeas corpus should not be abridged, as it says.
Yeah. Carl Estabrook, Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and whether the Constitution is a living document, we'll find
out. Have you looked at the polls about what Americans believe on torture? I've heard it cited.
I heard it on NPR
both,
this morning.
Both ways. Yeah. I've mm-hmm. heard it cited on NPR that occasional use of torture is accepted by, but on, early, by 37%. But I earlier heard a study that said exceptional use or something. I'm not sure what poll either of them were citing, but
that's a number I'm sure is very susceptible to the formulation of the question. I mean, you ask if there's a ticking bomb about to blow up a school full of young children, and you know that the man in front of you knows how to turn the bomb off, and only he does, would you, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, the ticking bomb thing, which the Israelis have used, you know, for a long time, works well, and people respond to that. Hard cases make bad law, as the maxim has it, and what happens is people start with the ticking bomb story and then say, well, okay, then a little torture is all right, and the Israelis go off and torture Palestinians, and the Americans go off and torture Iraqis on the grounds that, hey, there might be a ticking bomb and there might be someone who knows.
Right. You know. Well, and then popular
not much
media,
of an argument.
Popular media has done so much to raise that image.
You know,
Jack Bauer is allowed to beat the hell out of somebody if he knows there's a ticking bomb.
And
of course, the plot line is that he does know that there is a ticking bomb because, you know, but that's screenplays, and that's Hollywood. That's not how it really is in the real world, it seems to me. And you're more likely to get the case with this Al-Libi guy who was beaten by the Egyptians mm-hmm. until he said, of course, we were trained in the use of ricin and in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda has ties to Iraq, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But like I said earlier, that's torture working for this administration.
Yes, it does.
Because they got the answer they wanted.
And certainly does work. I mean, they've made that clear. Did you see this thing in Capitol Hill Blue?
No, you always go there. I rely on you
like
to tell me about it.
I like Capitol Hill Blue. They've always... This is a... a Washington publication of basically retired reporters and others, folks. It's they run it on a sort of a shoestring. It's halfway between a blog and a a newsletter.
I'll have to bookmark it and go there more often.
That they've been interested in all along is Bush's mental health. They're mm-hmm. the ones who publicized the book by the guy at George Washington University, Bush on the Couch, and have talked about the reports about the people who were trying to keep Bush straight with drugs and trying to keep him together. The latest report is, and they say they have three sources of Republican legislators who were called to the White House to discuss the Patriot Act, and in the course of the discussion, one of the president's aides, according to the account, said, of course, there were some constitutional problems with one of the things, with some of the things they wanted to continue in the Patriot Act. And Bush screamed, "Don't tell me about that goddamn scrap of paper. I'm commander in chief, and I want it done my way." Now, that's the quote, as a Capitol Blue claims they have three legislators who told them that, and that this is the sort of thing. It certainly captures the attitude with which the White House seems to be working, including the erratic character of it.
One of them wasn't Senator Byrd, or he would have whipped out his little pocket-sized constitution and flailed Bush. That would have been a good,
Image too. Republican legislators, they said. The sort of things that Bush has done, immediately after Jack Murtha's, Representative Murtha's speech calling for withdrawal from Iraq, the White House immediately says, oh, he's joined the Michael Moore wing of the Democratic Party. The people realized, really, they couldn't get away with saying that. They immediately backtrack on that. But this sort of erratic quality and the increasing reports of rifts between the president's people and the vice president's people and so forth suggests that they really are in disarray. And that's dangerous because that means that, a nutsy Bush who sees the Constitution as a scrap of a piece of paper may decide, unleash the Israelis on Iran. Why don't we?
Mm. Yeah, Murtha... Did he respond with that to the? Well, that was the original.
No, I was conference. The original. That was the his original talk. His response, as a matter of fact, response is very much to Bush's speech. His Council of Foreign Relations speech is very much worth reading. I happened to catch it live on television, Murtha's response, that is, and then read the text of it, and it's extremely good. I mean, this is a right-wing Democrat representative, close to the military, and so...
There were 33 years in the Marines.
But he simply sets out the reasons why this this charm offensive that the White House has undertaken to try to sell the war, and by repeating the word victory 15 times, apparently, in the first speech. I don't know how many in the Council of Foreign Relations speech. But in any case, what Murtha does is just simply take it apart. I mean, all the arguments being put forward, such as they are, by the White House, have been deconstructed by Representative Murtha, a right-wing Democrat, and... he's scaring Democrats to death. I mean, other Democrats are screaming that they're going to be found to be soft on defense now. And, of course, the real hawks in the party, like Clinton and Kerry, continue to say, oh, yes, we have to win this one. That's a quote from Mrs. Clinton this last week.
No.
Nevertheless, what Murtha says is devastating in its destruction of the White House position.
The clips that I heard that public radio was playing and replaying at least a couple of times were mainly the one about him making the distinction between terrorists and the insurgents.
Yes.
Using the word specifically, I guess, to be Rummy's face, since he doesn't want us to
exactly.
use it anymore.
That's
but
right.
The idea that we're fighting terrorists in Iraq is
yep.
just ludicrous beyond belief.
When everyone admits that at no more than 5% or so of the resistance in Iraq are foreign fighters at all, and even if all the foreign fighters can be considered al-Qaeda, which is mainly a boogeyman for the American administration, still the resistance is homegrown. The insurgency, and that's what it is very definitely homegrown, and the U.S., the reason Bush has to make the distinctions in his speech is that the U.S. has been secretly negotiating and talking to groups within that insurgency for months.
Yeah.
And, may well, as a result, be able to do what the administration obviously wants to do, get some troops, be able to point to a substantial number of troops that it can say it has withdrawn from Iraq this winter. That's clearly what they want to do.
Yeah, well, if they do what Hirsch has speculated about, start bombing from the air more than they are already, I don't think that would they have much of a negotiation. Which is interesting to hear that they're negotiating with the elements when they say they won't talk to any
of course.
Won't talk at all to the people that are holding the Brothers of the Sword, is it, that are holding the CPT team?
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas Jack Straw has announced that they would they're trying to open a channel or something like that. And the outpouring on these people's behalfs who work, you know, again, it's been said lately on the regular that they had all the chapter and verse on Abu Ghraib before any of the pictures came out because they were interviewing people who had just gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew
exactly.
They knew what was going on, and they actually sent a contingent, CPT sent a contingent to Capitol Hill and tried to get anybody they could to listen to the stories they had of what was going on and what is probably generally still going on all over Iraq, not just in the prisons.
Well, it just makes it clear once again where the vast range of lies coming from this administration are directed. I mean, it's the American populace. Rumsfeld himself had another one this week. Rumsfeld says, "I'm absolutely bald-faced, thinks he can get away with it, and probably can. We never made any predictions about how the war would go. We never said it was going to be easy," says Rumsfeld this week. Well, I mean, immediately people pull up all the sorts of things that they did say about how it was going to be easy, how it would only take a couple of months, how it would be paid for by the oil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Rumsfeld can get away with standing there and saying, we didn't say it was going to be easy, we didn't make any predictions. The same way they can get away with not having any of those weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to be such an imminent threat to us.
What do you think of the rumor that he's going to be replaced by Lieberman? Maybe he can keep lying as he knows he's... But why would
a thought, too.
Why would he retire only a couple of blocks from Cheney? He's got another house. He bought another house over by where Cheney is. Cheney's got a air traffic pattern he just instituted that all the small plane pilots can't fly over that area.
Well, that's the old, Cheney's official residence is the old Naval Observatory up Massachusetts Avenue there, and I think that's been true for a while. I mean,
well, but he has a place over in Maryland somewhere, too, and the story is that, of course, maybe it's Rummy that actually changed the traffic pattern and blamed it on Cheney. I don't know.
He's got to live there because he can't leave the country because he'll be indicted if he goes to any other country.
Well, he still maintains this residence in northern Illinois near the Chicago area. That's why one of the suits against him that's being prosecuted by an ex-JAG, Navy JAG guy. I haven't heard anything more about that case lately, and I don't remember. There's so many different infractions to hang it on. I don't remember actually which one that is.
So Rumsfeld can be indicted if he comes to Illinois, which seems to be
There is a case proceeding, and they did since he owns a place in Santa Fe now in Maryland and in Illinois. They picked what they thought where they might get the best judge.
Speaking of such suits, did you see that the former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli FBI, just going to do more than FBI, but in any case, his name is Avi Dichter, is being sued in the U.S. by a suit put together by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. The suit is on behalf of 14 members of a family, of a couple of families that were killed in one of the assassinations that had been set up by Shin Bet in the West Bank. I mean, airplanes hit a building.
One of which happened this week in Gaza.
And they did it again, yeah. But, I mean, this has been standard practice, as we know, from the Israelis. But it was interesting. Dichter was apparently in the U.S., so they could serve him with the suit. He has been served in the U.S., and he is being sued by this Palestinian family for the deaths in their families.
I'm happy to hear the Center for Constitutional Rights has picked up that case. I hadn't heard about that at all.
The assassinations this week, I think, are important and are bound up with the coming Israeli elections. I mean, what the Israeli government here is doing, as usual, is transparent. They're trying to produce reactions. They're trying to produce outrages. They're trying to produce a security threat to get the new or the existing government reconfigured as far as party is concerned back into office. A very good piece by a fellow whose writings on Israel I think are very good, Ron Ha-Cohen, who writes on the anti-war website, antiwar.org, I guess it is. Libertarian website, but they put up some very good things, and Huck Cohen points out that what's been confirmed by the Israeli papers this week, that the thing that concerns the Israeli electorate the most right now is not relationship with the Palestinians or the threat of suicide bombings. It's the economy. The Israeli economy is in terrible shape, and people will vote, according to an article in Haaretz this week, people in Israel will vote in the upcoming elections on the basis of the economy, that is, which party they think can do something about the increasingly bad economic situation. What's happened in Israel is that the differences between rich and poor have continued to increase, so that Israel and the U.S. are neck and neck right now as to which society is more unequal, both of them far more unequal than the other industrialized countries. That is, in terms of wealth and income, the gap is far greater in Israel and the U.S. than it is in the other industrialized countries, and Israel is about to set new records in this regard, and they're feeling it on the ground in Israel, and they're going to vote on it, apparently.
Yeah. I'd point out again that it's not an accident that the Labor Party that Shimon Peres abandoned this past week now is headed by a non-Ashkenazi, by a Sephardi guy.
Yeah, it's probably more important that he is some sort of a gentle social democrat, though, yeah. And I mean, actually,
well,
has worked through.
Well, I don't think
the...
it's an accident that goes together, because I believe race and class are, and ethnicity and class are.
Yeah, well, in fact,
intertwined.
In fact, the Oriental Jews, as they used to be called, support Likud more in numbers more than they have Labor. Labor has always been seen as an Ashkenazi party. And one of the things that Amir Peretz, the new head of the Labor Party, wants to do is to attract more and more of the Sephardic Jews to the Labor Party banner. Mm. But I mean, you know, he came up through Histadrut, through basically the AFL-CIO of Israel, which is deeply involved in the with the military and with the occupation and so forth. I mean, it's a thoroughly compromised organization from beginning to end, and he's not a particularly radical figure. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in any case. There is an amazing editorial on the front page, or on the editorial page of the New York Times today, entitled Hugo Chavez and His Helpers. This is the New York Times now, you know. This starts with a description of Chavez as a quasi-dictator. Here's a man who has won many more elections by much greater numbers than, say, the government, the president of the United States. It goes on to refers to his demagoguery, and then talk about his burgeoning friendship with Iran, which is the reason that it's a very bad idea that Chavez be allowed to buy a nuclear reactor from Brazil. No. I mean, this is the sort of stuff the Times wrote about Nicaragua, for example, before the Reagan administration launched its proxy war on Nicaragua and killed thousands of people there. This is horrible and irresponsible journalism. The New York Times, with its reputation of being a liberal paper, in fact, is its politics are essentially those of the Bush administration, because it's essentially those also of the possible Democratic administration. A very good example of how this system works is a very good article on Counterpunch this week about our own Illinois Representative Rahm Emanuel, who is in the business of making sure that no progressive Democrats or no anti-war Democrats get slated for those very few congressional seats that are up in 2006. I mean, technically, all the congressional seats are up for votes, but of the 435 congressional seats, there are only about 20 that are actually in play, that the incumbents don't have a lock on because of gerrymandering. And the man who has been given the job by the Democratic Party of making sure that these seats remain in Democrat hands, they remain in the hands they are now, because that's the malign deal between the Democrats and Republicans, that we keep, that everybody keeps the seats they have now. Emanuel, as the director of congressional campaigning for the Democratic Party, has done a particularly nasty job in DuPage County, where a progressive Democrat really might have beaten Henry Hyde in the 2006 election, except for the fact that Emanuel and the Democratic Party are busily running primary challengers to this woman who could have beat who ran against Hyde last time and could beat him this time. Astonishing stuff.
Maybe it'll blow back in their face.
I hope so.
I had some more about Chavez, though. When you bring up the Times current editorial, one should be reminded of what they did when the temporary coup that happened the weekend that Chavez was held in prisoner in the presidential palace. Unbeknownst to them, there were people below that were ready to free him, and also there was a mass of people that came out against this coup of basically installing the Chamber of Commerce head as the new president. The New York Times covered itself with glory by applauding the coup that Saturday. And they never really did do anything to correct their supposed commitment to democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And they mentioned Mercosur, too, because that's another interesting show. Venezuela has just joined Mercosur, which mercantile south, like right. Telesur. It's the southern market, basically. And the fact that Venezuela is in there is probably unsettling the people at Langley and the White House as well, that Chavez, far from being marginalized, is becoming more central to the politics of and economics of Latin America. Despite this thing with the opposition boycotting the election and having absolutely no representation in the parliament at all, you wonder who was counseling that.
The reason is obvious. I mean, they say, "Oh, look, that's what happened is the opposition pulled out of the election, and therefore has no representation in the Venezuelan parliament, so that the New York Times can write stories of the quasi-dictator who has no opposition in Congress."
Yeah.
I mean, it works very well. The New York Times role in this, you're quite right, Paul. I mean, that the coup, of course, was under a previous editor in the New York Times. The present editor, Bill Keller, is probably, if anything, even further to the right, that is, further in bed with, Democrat and Republican foreign policy, than the previous one was. So, I mean, it's not surprising that we're getting editorials like this, and they are being presented as, of course, the liberal view.
Right. Well, the more liberal of the policy journals, foreign policy, not to be confused with foreign affairs, as we pointed out some time ago, is edited by a very vehemently anti-Chavista Venezuelan American. It's not just the press, it's the intellectual establishment. And it's great that indeed we'll have something from a first-hand report from the ambassador. And he studied development policy in Sussex, England, did a master's there. So I think he'll be talking about the Bolivarian Revolution in a way that it never gets treated here, that it's actually instituting schools in places where there are never schools. It's sharing the... It's probably, as Naomi Klein has pointed out, I think that's where I read, it's pointed out that the only place in the world, and certainly in Latin America, where oil wealth is actually being distributed to
yes,
the poor is...
Exactly.
Is Venezuela, which...
And I think that's the reason the administration... That's the reason the New York Times is particularly concerned about it, and the administration is particularly concerned about it. Jose Serrano, the New York representative from the South Bronx, congressional representative from the South Bronx, arranged oil from Venezuela through Citgo for heating oil for the people in his district, and a Massachusetts representative, I think it was Delahunt, did the same thing for poor people in Massachusetts. This is a terrible black eye for the administration, because people look at this and say, well, that's great, this cut rate for oil is being provided, but not by our government and not by the oil companies, but by the president of Venezuela. And that, as a propaganda coup, it seems to me a wonderful one, and one that I think the administration is really quite upset with.
Yeah. In the way of a Simon watch, this is typical material this morning on NPR, if you listen to Weekend Edition, as I do regularly, just so I can complain. they did a piece on this group Platform that has this, I believe, expose out about what's going on with the oil in Iraq. He didn't use the name of this piece. They mentioned Platform. It's a British-based group, though they have some people over here on this side that are working on. They talk about this production sharing agreements and how it's a way to privatize the oil and make sure the largesse goes to the oil companies and not to the government or the people, except for whatever kickbacks Chalabi will get out of it. But the name of the report is called Crude Designs, and you can find it on the web at crudedesigns.org. Simon, who fancies himself a wordsmith and fond of clever phrases, didn't mention the name of the piece. I mean, I found that to be typical, not terribly insightful if you listen to Scott Simon he's such a celebrity in public radio circles, and he just doesn't deserve it at all.
Well. Given what public radio is, I mean, what we laughingly call public radio in this country, you know, I mean, just remember what the British mean when they say public schools, I guess. Speaking of things British, by the way, the Brits are working very hard to cover up a $1.3 billion theft through the Ministry of Defense in Iraq that they apparently were responsible for. This was exposed by a British journalist, it's causing great dismay in Britain, in the Blair government. At the same time, the Blair government looks like it actually has some opposition from across the aisle of the House of Commons.
I'm not terribly impressed by this young guy that they put
Cameron, David up. Cameron, the new head of the Tory Party.
You know, the $8 billion went missing over on from the U.S. coffers.
The
it was actually Iraqi money.
That's about proportional with British, right? You know,
yeah,
eight times as much for
British. But it was less commented on here. I mean, people were railing about the malfeasance at the United Nations and oil for food when, you know, the bigger scandal was going on right as they were railing, and they could have railed against the fact that this $8 billion, I really think it went off to... a lot of it was used to grease the wheels for the previous election cycle, which I guess we have one coming up this week, don't
we? That's right. That's
so
right.
I wonder where they're swindling the money to.
That's probably why they needed $1.3 billion in a hurry. Huh? we're talking about the fact that there are elections for the Iraqi parliament coming up on the 15th, and it's 5 days from now. Yeah, the U.S. is concerned, of course, because to make sure that it has a appropriately tractable parliament and its puppet government, and that will allow the U.S. to say, aha, here we've established democracy, therefore we're going to withdraw some National Guard troops and so forth, and everyone will say, well, then the administration is moving in the right direction. They have no intention of leaving, of course, and they aren't going to, but at least it's, you know... Hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, and they have to be hypocritical about it.
Yeah, and we can criticize, and we do criticize the Democratics' lame alternative. But
absolutely.
I think it's fair to point out that Kerry, even during the campaign, said we should announce that we have no intention of keeping these bases, which, you know.
He did say that for what it's worth. Right now he's busily distancing himself from the anti-war Democrats and saying, well, we have to think about some drawdown in 2006 or something like that. And instead we have splendid things like Murtha's response to Bush's CFR, Council for Foreign Relations speech. I gather Bush gave that speech, by the way. Someone from one of the Washington blogs printed a timeline from the moment at which the Bush enters the limousine at the White House, driving to the hotel where the Council of Foreign Relations is meeting, giving the speech, and being back into the White House, disappearing inside of the White House, was less than an hour.
Really?
It was all carefully organized, 10:30 to 11:30 in the morning. So
they had to overturn the longstanding tradition that there always be a colloquy after a speech.
Yes, be no questions. That's right. Bush took no questions. The crucial point.
Yeah, and no backdrop either. They couldn't have any kind of victory in Iraq imagery behind it. He's supposed to give another one before the election, so there's one scheduled at the beginning of this week. I don't know where that one will be, but not in a hostile. I assume they presume that that was more of a neutral environment. So, no, maybe he will. Maybe he'll one in a hostile environment.
I think the fact of the matter is, I mean, the reason they had to say no questions from the Council of Foreign Relations, Council of Foreign Relations has always been sort of a group of American foreign policy elite for a long time. But the dismay with which the Iraq policy, the Middle East policy, the foreign policy in general of this administration is greeted with by that foreign policy elite is so great that they couldn't afford to take any questions from this group. Right. They would have gotten some serious and hostile ones. And you know, can't have that, not with this president, at least.
Zbigniew Brzezinski and Odom and all these types are railing about it. You know, it's clear that there would have been some kind of... diplomatically, but
Brzezinski is a snake, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, is a terror. And an interesting sidelight on that came out this week. December 7th, of course, is an important date. I was interested in how little was mentioned of Pearl Harbor this past December 7th.
Whereas last year it was...
Yeah, and part of it is the numbers. Yeah, I mean, you know, 64 years or something. It's not a round number. But in any case... I think it has also has to do with the fact that the historian Arthur Schlesinger pointed out very early on that the doctrine of preemptive war that the Bush administration was putting forward was precisely the doctrine the Japanese government was using at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, yeah.
And that that this is the, you know, so parallels or at least historical reflections on how the attack on Pearl Harbor is like the invasion of Iraq was something, obviously, that supporters of the administration didn't want this year. I got some other December 7th things.
I've got one that is kind of a digression, but why don't I digress? And it has to do with our namesake Noam Chomsky.
Well, that was my second one.
Pointing out that the 9/11 attack was actually the worst attack on U.S. soil in history, because at the time of the attack of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii wasn't a state.
Well, worse than not being
a territory.
Worse than not being a state, it was a colonial outpost that had been stolen from its inhabitants.
Swindled, yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
I saw a Native American poet who lives in Hawaii now named Joy Hargrove this week. Missed another thrilling WEFT meeting because of it.
You saw some of her performance, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and she. I talked to her afterwards about the indigenous movement in Hawaii. Asked if people there thought the U.S. might go back to 49 states anytime soon, and she said, "Well, we all hope so."
Yeah, I bet.
But it wasn't. You know, we had the Philippines in at that time too. You know, we were the Pacific power
exactly
at that time.
Well, and that. And, of course, once again, these were colonial outposts that the U.S. had seized in the Pacific. Look, most Americans forget that the Second World War for the United States was primarily a war against the Empire of Japan for control of the Pacific. The U.S. didn't even declare war on Germany until Germany had declared war on the United States in concert with its ally, Japan. And, of course, the war had been going on for more than 2 years before the U.S. ever got into it. This came up again in some way just this last week, where it was being pointed out once again that the American belief that the Second World War was won on the Normandy beaches, you know, is quite false. At the time of the Normandy landings and from then to the end of the war, 80% of the Wehrmacht, of the German army, was on the Eastern Front fighting the Russians. And, of course, it was the Russians who won the Second World War in Europe by defeating the Wehrmacht. So, I mean, our history, or what we remember of the Second World War, which is not usually the history, it's dangerous for the administration to look at that very, very closely, and it seems to me that had something to do with the downplaying of.
I don't know. The stuff is so heretical that it can be dismissed as fringe,
perhaps,
very, very quickly.
There's a third anniversary though for December 7th. We should mention it was the 30th anniversary of the Indonesian invasion of East Timor. And this brings us back to Brzezinski we were talking about a moment ago. Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor, was responsible for keeping secret behavior of President Ford and Secretary of State Kissinger at the time of the invasion of East Timor. Ford and Kissinger were in fact in Jakarta as the invasion was being prepared, and they of course gave their blessing to the Indonesians. After all, they were our boys, a client state. They gave their blessings to the Indonesians, but said that they were not to launch the invasion until Kissinger and Ford got out of Indonesia.
Interval kind of thing, yeah.
And the traffic, the cables and the information going back and forth on this issue were embargoed, of course, for the longest time. And it was Brzezinski who did his best to keep the lid on it, yeah, so that what stuff wasn't published finally was published through the NSA, yeah, through the National Security Archive, a very good group. But the notion that Brzezinski represents sort of another side, an opposite view to the view of the Kissingers of this world. I mean, look, these are
it's
these
a
people.
Factional dispute within the ruling elite, right?
But the faction, the split is very small. These are people within the same ruling elite, the same foreign policy elite, and their differences, such as they are differences within a common goal, and that goal is not to the good of the people of the United States or the people of the world.
Are you traveling by air anytime soon?
You mean, am I one of the 80,000, do you think? 80,000 people on the watch list? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I was thinking of this guy that came back from Ecuador where he was doing missionary work, apparently, who was off this week because he made a stupid joke. And
more lie. Well, we don't even know he made a stupid joke. We can't get a straight story out of it. It's like the shooting of the guy in the subway in London. I mean, the lies. I thought today's theme, as a matter of fact, from beginning to end, from Condi Rice to, you know, they shot a man in Miami just to watch him die, you know, that the federal agents lying about what went on there. Apparently, no one except the federal agents heard this guy who was running off the plane when he was shot five times in the head or whatever. No one but the federal agents heard him mention bomb. The federal agents apparently went through the passengers, you know, trying to find someone who would say that he had heard and what the federal agents called the B word, so help me. No, and they meant bomb, yeah. Even more shocking is what, well, not more shocking than killing the guy, but part of the same operation was the federal air marshals holding at gunpoint and threatening with guns the rest of the passengers, striking cell phones out of their hands, yelling at them not to look at what they were doing, you know, and after the shooting went down in the air corridor and that
Skyway,
thank you, to the airplane. I mean, it was a horrible operation, Paul, and I mean, you don't know how much of it is, I mean, the thuggery of the air police in this regard is, unfortunately, only what's to be expected, I guess.
And I heard Rush Limbaugh say, hey, the 911 commission must have been wrong. They actually are doing something.
Yeah, they're
Miami,
shooting people, shooting innocent people, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and once again, surrounded again by a bodyguard of lies, as the London shooting was. You know, let's hope it'll cost somebody their job, at least in America.
Well, but what it actually does, it agitates people and makes them more susceptible. They haven't raised the terror alert in a while. I expect that to be done just to distract people and to, make us return to the idea that pushes... Bush is the one that can handle it, which, given his ratings.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of ratings, I wanted to mention I clipped some stuff from Corp Watch about disaffection with corporate power. What's amazing is how high it's been consistently. 72% of respondents feel that wrongdoing is widespread of industry. Last year it was 66, so two-thirds, and it's gone to 7 out of 10. Only 2% checked off very trustworthy to describe the chief executives of very large corporations, down from 3% last year. Only 9% said they had full trust in financial institutions, down from 14. It was as high as 3 out of 20 last year.
That's more than the number of Iraqi, the percentage of Iraqis who think the U.S. is there to help them. So, yeah. I mean, at least. look, this is a real issue, Paul. I mean, this is, I wrote recently that I really thought that the fundamental fight within the Bush administration was looters versus killers. And it's the looters who are most concerned about this. And business was, it was sort of business as usual for them this week, in the sense that the House very quietly okayed the tax cuts, for dividends and capital gains. I mean, this is going on under the radar. This is not being talked about. Even the Patriot Act takes away a little attention from things like this, because the Bush administration is mainly concerned about securing the concerns of what Bush calls, in Michael Moore's movie, my base, that is, the very wealthy. Right. And that was ticking over nicely all week amidst all the lies. These are the things that the lies are really meant to cover. Right. But from lies from Brussels to Miami, what the administration is really lying about is who it's working for.
Yeah, well, the opposition party would look at these figures and you think they would say, you know, we
yeah.
need to campaign
what
against
opposition
corporate
party,
power,
Paul?
But,
yeah,
but it
exactly.
ain't going to happen. One thing that was under the radar in this there was some unison on some of these tax cuts, the ones about dividend and all that were controversial and passed on party lines. But there's another expansion of medical savings accounts, which is an outrageous thing to expand. I mean, what it's going to do is exacerbate the problems in the healthcare system by quite a bit, because people are going to go to these high overhead or high deductible insurance policies, and it's going to separate the rich and the poor in the pool. And these are tax deductible savings that people are allowed to do if they have these high deduction. It's a little bit complicated, but basically it's a continuation of the undermining of what little there is in a shared pool of risk for medical and health problems, and it's going to exacerbate things. But it was passed without much comment, so I think it was one thing that needed to be mentioned. But then the business reporters that report what's called news in the business pages are probably highly invested in medical industry, et cetera, and they don't want to rock the boat.
I've got a last lie, obviously not a last lie, but the last one I have time for today. A last lie coming from Montreal, where the climate where the climate meeting is going on. Bill Clinton stated, there was a report that the Bush administration told the people at the climate meeting that they wouldn't cooperate at all if the conveners invited Bill Clinton. So the conveners invited Bill Clinton, and he came and gave a speech in which he said that Bush in which he lied, because Clinton said Bush is flat wrong when he says that the Kyoto Agreement will not have a negative effect on American business. Well, of course the Kyoto Agreement will have a negative effect on American business. That's why they're against it, and that's why they want to stop it. But Clinton, who, you know, has never run into a principle that he actually would like to embrace, no, needn't play out the pun, is a is perfectly willing to lie about that too, in order for, you know, pure demagogical purposes.
Well, this is a little hard to do in a couple of minutes, but what I find astonishing is that his life, the books on tape thing, is very popular in audio. People, Bush and has been so bad that people are actually nostalgic for Bill Clinton, which is certainly damning of Bush. But actually, the turmoil in Montreal is a whole other issue we should return to.
Inshallah, we'll do it next week.